Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. I have an uncle whose politics are very right-wing. I mean very right-wing. My politics are, well, let's just say they're not the same as his. So we've gotten used to agreeing to disagree on just about everything. But a funny thing happened the other night. He started talking about climate change and about how polar bears are drowning because they now have to travel so far to habitat that used to be covered in solid ice, only now it's all melting. And he was quoting statistics on how much of the polar ice cap will be gone in the next 50 years. And I could hardly believe my ears. "You mean you actually believe in climate change?" I asked. "Well," he said, "you can't argue with science." On today's Soundprint, as part of our special series, Poll to Poll, producer Margot Foster of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation takes a journey to the heart of global climate change, Antarctica. What's happening there? Is the ice really melting so dramatically? We find out on her South Ocean voyage.
We're all those traveling on the ship to Antarctica, please start boarding the vessel now so we can check you off.
See ya.
Enjoy yourself. You'll have a great
time. Okay.
You, see you look after yourself. Yeah. Have a good trip.
I'm Margot Foster, and I'm going up the gangway of the icebreaker, the Aurora Australis. There are 75 of us, including leading scientists and their students, and a specialised crew of 20. Today, we sail for Antarctica.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Martin Riddle. I'm the voyage leader for V3, the Collaborative East Antarctic Marine Census. This, as you all know, is part of the International Polar Year. It's a voyage that has about 54 scientists on board, and it's part of an international collaboration that will be happening all around Antarctica. Welcome to the Aurora Australis, and I look forward to getting to know you all over the next 6 weeks of the voyage. We're heading down towards Commonwealth Bay, and we'll be working in the area between the French station at Dumont d'Urville and the Mertz Glacier over to the east. We've got a big job ahead of us, as you know, and I encourage you all to get settled in early, get your equipment sorted out, get it tied down. We could be in for some rough weather.
Tell me a little bit about your role as voyage leader.
Well, I've got a number of roles on the ship. I'm voyage leader, so I set the overall direction for the voyage. I'm the interface between the scientists and the ship through the captain. I'm also the representative of the Antarctic Division on this voyage, making sure that we achieve what we've been set out to do. I'm also the chief scientist, so I have responsibilities not just for the operational aspects of the voyage, but also for the scientific aspects. And then on top of that, I also have an interest in some of the particular research projects as a research scientist.
So tell me about some of the key objectives for Voyage 3.
Well, Voyage 3 is part of an International Polar Year project. It's part of the Census of Antarctic Marine Life. The other side of it is the climate work that we'll be doing. That's also an International Polar Year project, and for that we'll be taking water samples right the way from the sea surface to the seabed, and from those water samples they'll be able to analyse the structure of the water and to see how that changes as we head south.
And what's the significance of this work? Has it been done in this region before?
The whole of the East Antarctic area is really a black hole for biodiversity. We really don't know what's there. It's probably the largest unexplored, undescribed area of biodiversity on this planet. Now, that's fundamentally interesting as science, but it's also practically important. This area of the planet, the Southern Ocean, is one of the areas that is most likely to be affected by global change quickly, particularly by increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere causing ocean acidification. We're likely to see those changes first in the Southern Ocean, and if we don't go down now and find out what's there, we won't even know what we've lost.
Our ship, the Aurora Australis, has just entered some loose pack ice, which means we're close to the Antarctic continent off Commonwealth Bay. And this is the section of ocean we'll be taking samples from during the journey. Well, I'm standing on E-deck in the corridor with Sarah Robinson, who's the Deputy Voyage Leader. Tell me what your role is.
Well, as Deputy Voyage Leader, I look after a lot of logistics work, so cargo, permits for a quarantine, things like that. One of my roles on this voyage is also as lab manager.
And on the ship, there's 54 scientists, and they're all undertaking work while we're travelling. So tell me how we're set up to cater for that.
Well, we have a number of labs on board here, some of which are temperature controlled and others which are wet areas and things like that. For this, obviously everyone needs to share, and that's the big thing with the labs on this ship, is that everyone gets their own little bit of space, but you have to be very patient and cooperative with the people around you as well.
Sarah, let's do a little walk about and have a look at the facilities that make the Aurora Australis a purpose-built science research vessel.
Ooh,
love those stabilisers.
Yeah. Very haunting. Yes, so this is our wet lab, or one of our wet labs, but it is known as the wet lab. And this is where everything from the trawl gets brought in and sorted and cleaned and things.
And so it's right next to the trawl deck. In
it
fact,
is.
We
it's
can hear
off.
It.
Yes, there's some people working on the winches by the sound of things. So we've got two large island sinks in the middle here for washing off and sorting samples.
And again, I've seen about 20 people working in here at a time.
It's pretty incredible, the number of people that can be in here at once and work around each other. It's very much you get used to literally doing a two-step with other people. You get used to their movements as well as your own.
That's right, because there's been a number of projects working concurrently. Of course, the French CMARC team takes up this part of the bench, but then Glenn with the division has been over here.
Yes.
And then we've had Brian.
With the Venom people, yes, they've got their own little bench space over here as well. So they all work together in sorting the trawl together in one spot, and then all those samples are then sort of divvied up between the groups as to who needs what, and then they all go off and prepare them how they need to for their sampling. So we have space here for that wet sampling work. We also have fume cupboard with chemical storage, microscopes, scales for weighing the fish. We have an autoclave over in the corner there.
And all tons of running
things.
Water.
Yes, that's right. Lots of sinks, lots of water. It gets very wet in here very quickly.
What's just happened?
I just brought up the trawl from the bottom.
The first trawl has come up, and there are huge tubs of mud being ferried into the wet lab. There's great excitement. It's an amazingly rich trawl. We're already seeing one phenomenon of Antarctic biodiversity, and that's gigantism. Sea spiders, sponges, and isopods are much bigger than anywhere else.
Very nice.
So exciting.
Giant sea spiders. In the tropics, these things are about the size of your thumbnail, but in Antarctica, they're the size of your hand.
This one looks bigger.
Wow,
you know,
what is that?
You know, it's a big ichneumonid or pentapod. You see, it's looking like a spider. You see, the funny thing in this animal, there were only legs. Not the whole body, only legs and a junction of legs. All the organs are in the legs, including the gonads.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Is that as large as they get?
The ship is operating like a factory, 24 hours a day, with the scientists, students and crew all on 12-hour shifts. Well, while teams of people are working on split shifts over in the wet lab, over here is oceanography. And right next to oceanography is a little place called the CTD room. I'm just going in there. The CTD room houses a large frame with a whole lot of bottles around it and a range of equipment. And the CTD is central to the work done by Steve Rintoul.
I'm a physical oceanographer based at CSIRO Marine and Atmospheric Research in Hobart.
You better tell me what CTD stands for.
CTD stands for conductivity, temperature, depth. So conductivity, we actually measure the electrical conductivity, but from that we derive the salinity, or the saltiness of the seawater.
Okay, it's a dedicated room for the facility. What does it allow for?
There's a door that opens in the side of the ship and provides a trolley that we run the instrument out on. The package includes 24 bottles to allow us to collect water from different sample depths. Each one of those carries about 10 liters of water. So those are around the outside of the package and makes it a pretty big setup. And then the CTD itself is in the middle. It measures the temperature and the salinity and the depth continuously as we lower the instrument down to the seafloor. So the instrument's just heading out the door now. We can see a big ice flow just outside the door. One of the tricks of doing this work in Antarctica is trying to make sure you can lower the instrument into water instead of onto the ice.
All right, it'll count you down. 3 meters, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
And it's just gone down now. How deep is it going this time?
To a little over 4,000 meters on this cast. So this will be one of the deepest casts we do on this trip.
Tell me what this part of the grid is set aside for. What formulated your decision about casting in this part of the ocean in particular?
In this part of the voyage, we're repeating some stations that we've done in previous years. And in particular, we're looking for changes in the ocean, and more specifically, changes in something called Antarctic bottom water, which is water that sinks near the continent of Antarctica and then spreads out from Antarctica along the bottom of the ocean and can be found in most of the world oceans spreading away from Antarctica. We're looking for changes in this water mass because it will tell us something about a global pattern of ocean currents called the overturning or thermohaline circulation that has a big influence on climate.
So you're actually following a kind of a deep valley on the ocean floor.
Yeah, that's right. So this line of stations that we've just done has been running out a canyon. It's really a remarkable feature on the seafloor. It's 1 or 2,000 meters deep and looks very much like seeing a canyon that you might see on land, one of the big river systems. But this canyon has been carved entirely below the ocean surface by strong currents and by debris flows, something called turbidites, that actually can scour the seafloor and carve these canyons out of the earth.
And this is an interesting cast as well because it's carrying a curious cargo. Can you tell me about the cup phenomena?
Yeah, down at 4,000 meters, obviously the pressure is very high. And so it's become a bit of a tradition for people to decorate styrofoam cups. We then attach them in a net bag to the CTD and lower it down to 4,000 meters. And the cups are crushed by the pressure and become maybe about a third to a quarter of their original size. So the drawings that people make on them shrink and they look pretty good.
Okay, well, I've got a cup in there, so I'll be keen to see how mine turns out. Have you got one in there?
I'll put mine in on the next cast.
Thanks, Steve. The Aurora has some great facilities, actually. We have a cool room here in front of us. This is Lab 5. And
it's very small. It'd be like stepping into a fridge.
It is. It's like very much like a fridge in the back of a shop, like a supermarket fridge or something like that.
And it's cold.
It is. This one's, I think, at 3 degrees. There's only one user in here at the moment. This is Harvey Marchant, who is looking at protists and basically phytoplankton and things under the microscope.
You've come at a brilliant time.
This is a bit cold in here, Harvey.
It's meant to be cold. It's 2.5 degrees. That's why I'm sort of rugged up in a freezer suit and a hat and normally wear gloves. You can hear a vacuum pump in the background. I'll turn that off. Slightly less noise. The rest of the noise is from the air conditioner in here, making the temperature nice and cool. The organisms that I'm looking at, the single-celled critters, come from the sea where their temperature is around 0 to -1, so that if I'm taking video footage or look at living critters, I want them to be close to the temperature they're used to as distinct from the temperature that I'm normally used to.
Now tell me, where did you find these critters?
I collected a bottle at 50 metres, which was the so-called chlorophyll maximum, where most of the microorganisms are in the water, and another sample at 100 metres, where there was really a lot of stuff, and that's the stuff that's falling out to the deep sea to feed all of the critters that live on the bottom, the filter feeders, that are making some of the benthic biologists very happy.
Now, what's it telling you, though, Harvey? You've found life in these samples. Is it something that you're going to bank up and then come back and compare and see how that life's being sustained? Or are you painting a picture of where life exists?
This is basically painting a picture of where life exists, because sometimes you get a lot of the organisms in the surface waters just basically living and dying there, and the carbon that they've soaked out of the atmosphere, they respire back to the atmosphere. And just their little shells and not much nutrient makes it to the seafloor. But what we're looking at here, and we've seen in a couple of other sites, there is a lot of carbon being transported from the surface waters to the deep water. This is where it can be out of circulation for hundreds of years, even thousands of years. So it's a very good thing if there are organisms predominantly that sink to the sea floor.
And where are we in terms of finding answers to how the ocean is performing as a carbon sink?
Oh, tricky question, because
the team spent 6 weeks collecting water samples, videos and samples of sediment and some of the animals living on the floor of the ocean. But what has all that data collection told them? Well, I caught up with a couple of the scientists who went on the voyage, Steve Rintoul from CSIRO and Martin Riddle from the Australian Antarctic Division, to find out how things have moved on.
We're able to get a really good picture of what's happening in the Southern Ocean and in Antarctica within a single year or two. In the past, most of our measurements were scattered over time or taken in different places at different times, and it was difficult to construct a very good picture of exactly what the state of the Southern Ocean was. So the collaboration and the multinational teams that were developed during the International Polar Year, they've really made a huge step forward in helping us understand the polar regions and how they influence the rest of the Earth system.
It has really opened the door on the diversity of marine life in the Antarctic. We all knew that it was highly diverse, but we really had no idea that it would be as diverse as it is. So a remarkable number of new species have been discovered. So this is really fundamental natural history, new species being discovered, added to the inventory of life on Earth. And it's important. We will not know what we may lose through climate change if we don't know what we had. So it's really important to get to create that inventory of life on Earth.
That was Steve Rintoul from CSIRO and Martin Riddle from the Australian Antarctic Division, who you heard from earlier as the voyage leader on Margot Foster's trip on the Aurora Australis. So there are two sides to the story of the V3 voyage, the biodiversity and the oceanography. We heard from Martin Riddle that the data collected on the voyage showed that the Southern Ocean was much more biodiverse than even the scientists thought it would be. Let's find out why.
Well, one of the driving forces of diversity is actually disturbance. Disturbance on different time scales, on different spatial scales, creates different patterns. So you get patterns of old growth, if you like, similar to an old growth forest. Think places that have been undisturbed for thousands of years, and slow growing species can grow up and dominate in those communities. In areas that are disturbed, perhaps by the keel of an iceberg can reach down to 450 meters and it can actually scrape everything off the seabed. And in doing so, it creates a bare pasture for new things to grow. And so that allows for the early colonizers, if you like, the weedy species, the fast-growing species, to get in. So they get in there quickly, and then gradually over time, the slow-growing species come through and take over. And so what we see in the Antarctic is actually a patchwork of disturbance and variability from all sorts of different forces. Icebergs is one, but the different sea ice cover is another. So in the shallow areas where there's a lot of light, plants will grow, seaweeds will grow. If they're covered with sea ice for most of the year, then it's sponges and other things that are more typically found in the deeper areas. One of the most amazing discoveries we found down there was a really rich, really diverse, really colourful, but very, very fragile cold water coral community. And interestingly enough, it was the only place throughout the entire 7-week voyage that we saw any fishing activity. So the fishing people knew that it was rich and diverse, and they were down there because they were at that site because of that. Now, the information that we got, the film footage and the samples that we had, were enough to convince the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources to declare this a vulnerable marine ecosystem. And it was the first vulnerable marine ecosystem declared in the Southern Ocean.
Ocean currents also play a role in determining where species can survive. And in fact, the ocean life itself can tell us about the direction and the flow of the currents.
We took lots of underwater video of what organisms were living on the seafloor. And in many places, there were lots of feather stars. These animals, they catch food by sticking their arms out across the current. And when they filter something out of the water, they then move the food into their mouth. We found that we can actually use the orientation of the feather stars because they tend to orient themselves across the current so they can catch more food. We can tell the current direction by looking at the orientation of the feather stars. So we've actually been using the starfish to map bottom current directions around the Antarctic shelf, which is something we've never thought of trying before.
Steve Rintoul from CSIRO's Marine and Atmospheric Research in Hobart.
During the trip, we went back to locations where we made measurements before, dating back to 1991. And what we're finding is that layer is becoming fresher, lower in salinity. And we think the cause of this is that the glacial ice, as it flows off the continent of Antarctica and into the ocean, is starting to melt more than it used to.
And what would the expected effects of the increasing freshness of the water be?
So far, it looks like the same amount of water is sinking, but it's just a little lighter than it used to be. So the impacts of that directly are not great yet. But what it does indicate to us is that even the deepest layers of the ocean are sensitive to changes in the high latitude climate. We also know that during past periods of Earth's history, when the waters around the poles had become fresher, they became so fresh and so light that it shut down that sinking process and shut down a global pattern of ocean currents that we call the overturning circulation. That circulation is the main way that the ocean carries heat and carbon dioxide and other properties around the globe and thereby influences climate. So we're not seeing a slowing down of that process yet, but the additional fresh water being added by melting ice is shifting things in that same direction.
So there haven't been any major changes in salinity levels yet, but something that is already changing is ocean acidity. This is down to a simple piece of school chemistry. Gases dissolve better in cold water. The CO2 in the atmosphere will dissolve into the water at the poles more easily than in warmer waters, making the cold seas more acidic first.
The southern ocean and the animals that live there are really, in some senses, the sentinels, the early warning of change that we will see in other parts of the planet.
Are we already seeing the effects?
We are certainly seeing measurable changes in the shells of some marine organisms. So shells from the pre-industrial era that we can take from sediments have slightly heavier shells than modern pteropods. So yes, we are seeing the early signs of this. And perhaps the most worrying thing is that the modellers are indicating that a critical threshold of pH will actually reach the surface of the Southern Ocean in winter time by 2038. So that is not very long.
If this critical acidity threshold does reach the surface, it will mean the loss of those fragile coral communities and could foreshadow what we could see happening to marine ecosystems closer to home in the future. But it's not just corals and plankton that will be affected. Krill are hugely important in many ocean chains, and they also need carbonates to build their shells. Rob King from the Australian Antarctic Division works on Antarctic krill and has shown that high acidity stops their eggs from hatching properly. He explains that we know increased acidity will be a bad thing for the krill, but we just can't be sure how great the wider effects will be.
If it prevents the reproduction of krill, you know, so many animals depend on krill. I mean, a blue whale can take, you know, up to a ton of krill in a mouthful. I mean, that's the reason that whales want to swim all the way down to Antarctica each year to go feeding. They gorge themselves on krill. But it's not just these big sort of charismatic megafauna. It's all of the little creatures down there that are relying on krill. I mean, and it's not just a one-way street. You know, nutrient cycling with krill are also key. I mean, the nutrients that go to feed the phytoplankton are partly coming from the excrement of krill. We have to remember that ecosystems don't just go from little to big, but the stuff that the big guys are doing are going back the other direction as well.
There were some really incredible moments during the trip. At one point, the ship was stopped and we were making some oceanographic measurements. And we saw some whale spouts quite a ways off. And it was a very calm day. And the whales swam a couple of kilometers straight to the ship and passed directly underneath where we were standing on the edge of the ship. And it was a mother humpback whale and two calves that then spent the entire 3 or 4 hours when we were making our measurements just swimming round and round around the ship and breaching and waving their flippers and flukes. And it was really a beautiful experience.
The aims of the V3 voyage were to catalogue the biodiversity of the study area and to investigate the ocean chemistry and the currents. They found huge diversity of life, but also fragility in the systems. Even with Camelar's protection as a vulnerable marine ecosystem, the chemical changes being seen already in the Southern Ocean could spell disaster for many species and could be an early warning of the fate that awaits other marine ecosystems like the corals of the Great Barrier Reef.
The stars are aligned for this sort of work. The Southern Ocean, people are realising, is one of the areas that is most vulnerable to climate change, particularly to increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we just don't know enough about it to understand exactly how much of a risk that is to the system. So there are these very practical reasons for extending the work that's been done on this voyage. It's not just about pursuing some archaic scientific interest. It is actually very valuable, very applied. It's answering some of the big questions of modern science.
Oh my God! They look amazing.
We got our keys. We have a project.
That's pretty cool. CMAP started. Hurrah!
All right. So we'll do the CDNA library and these guys as soon as you get back. Have the results by April.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Plug it in with our temperate stuff. I'll just by June.
South Ocean Voyage was produced by Margot Foster and Sarah Castor Perry of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It airs as part of Pole to Pole, an international media celebration of the International Polar Year, produced with support from the National Science Foundation. You can find the rest of that series online at our website, soundprint.org. There are listening links, as well as links to lots of additional information, both online and on paper. The address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. Your feedback makes these collaborations and our regular programming better. So drop us a line at talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint can be purchased for a small fee. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES to order your favorite episodes. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.